This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll visit a little free library in Green Bay that's spreading art instead of books. Now we're about a year away from the 2022 midterm elections, and there are some election-related things to talk about here in Wisconsin. First, 4 days after the Racine County Sheriff accused state election officials of breaking election law, there haven't been any charges brought forward. Sheriff Christopher Schmeling said the Wisconsin Elections Commission barred poll workers from helping nursing home residents cast their ballots during last November's presidential election. Though Schmeling made the allegations, he's not recommending charges. He wants Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call to investigate. Some Republican lawmakers, including Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, are calling on election commissioners to resign. Five of the six members say the sheriff is wrong and that they've done good work helping people vote during the pandemic. In other news, Rebecca Clayfish is calling for Republicans to engage in so-called ballot harvesting to help her beat Governor Tony Evers next year, arguing that Democrats are already doing it. She's gotten some pushback on the idea, in particular from a potential primary opponent. Molly Beck is a state government and politics reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel following both of those stories. Molly, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Molly, let's start in Racine County. What exactly is the sheriff saying happened at these nursing homes?
So the sheriff's press conference focused on one nursing home in Mount Pleasant. And he says at that nursing home, there were about eight residents that families describe as not being in good cognitive health, I would say, and they ended up voting in the 2020 November election. Of those eight, there was one person who had been deemed by a judge to be incompetent to vote, which is the only legal reason a person can be barred from voting, aside from criminal reasons. So the sheriff is saying that the Wisconsin Elections Commission, because of their advice last year during the pandemic, broke the law. They led to these residents voting in this nursing home, which he described as being, you know, nursing home administrators coercing the residents to vote. And he blames that on the guidance from the Elections Commission.
Well, let's break this down kind of a step at a time. In a normal, non-pandemic year, generally, as I understand, Molly, there would be these special voting deputies who go to nursing homes, right? That's how state mm-hmm. how it's supposed to work?
That's right. So special voting deputies are trained poll workers who make two attempts to go to nursing homes to see if they can help residents vote. But if they're unable to do that after two attempts, then they just send absentee ballots. And so the administrator of the Elections Commission says that, you know, the sheriff's allegations and some Republican lawmakers' allegations that they broke the law, those allegations are false because the law does say that if you cannot get into a nursing home to send absentee ballots. She held a press conference today and said that at that time that they passed this policy, the commissioners passed this policy, that nursing homes weren't allowing people to come in anyway.
Yeah, and the process would be two of these voting deputies going from room to room and possibly two election observers. So nursing homes that during the pandemic didn't want two to four people going from one room to another with these vulnerable patients there. That was the reasoning behind this guidance?
Right. So the initial vote to pass this policy and this guidance was back in March of 2020. And if we remember what was going on then, it was right when the pandemic started. And there was a lot of concern about nursing homes because, you know, there were reports of, you know, one resident getting sick in a nursing home and then, you know, it just spread everywhere and a lot of people would die. And so that's where those concerns were coming from. Republicans are saying, and the sheriff in his investigation said all these other kinds of people were allowed in those nursing homes, like DoorDash delivery drivers and people who are apparently cleaning fish tanks, things like that. Those are the examples they gave. So they're, you know, they're contending that the special voting deputies should have been allowed in too.
You are right in the piece that in 2020, the election commissioners had urged lawmakers to modify the law, I'm quoting from your piece here, so they could more easily address voting in nursing homes. Did Republicans do anything to kind of resolve this, you're supposed to send voting commissioners, but they might not be let in, issue?
The lawmakers did not meet in most of 2020, so there was not any legislation to address that issue in 2020 when those you know, during the spring and then the fall election. Lawmakers have since put forward some legislation since then to address that, but that specific issue was not addressed last year.
And Molly, with the idea of potential charges, either against the Election Commission itself or against people who helped the residents vote, including, as you said, in one case, somebody who had been legally ruled not able to vote, who would be filing charges? What are the prospects at this point?
So what happened, the initial complaint came to the Elections Commission. They forwarded that to the Racine County District Attorney, who then referred that to the Racine County Sheriff for an investigation. And if what likely happens in that situation is if there is, you know, reason to bring charges, then that would be something that the district attorney would do.
We're talking to Molly Beck from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a couple of election related issues here in Wisconsin. I want to turn to the other one we invited you to talk about, Molly, that you've been following. Rebecca Clayfish, former lieutenant governor of the state, Republican candidate in their primary for governor. She told Republicans at an event last month they need to engage in ballot harvesting. She said, she was quoted as saying, Democrats do it, ballot harvesting, nonstop, and they go hard. Republicans must go harder. Can you talk about her call for ballot harvesting, not because she says she likes it, but because the other side, she says, is doing it?
Right. She said earlier, or I guess last month now, it's November 1st. she said that she wanted to engage in these practices that she says Democrats engage in and what helped them win in 2020. She wants to hire what she calls mercenaries. And she also said that she wanted to engage in a practice called ballot harvesting, which would allow third parties to gather ballots. And but at the same time, she doesn't want to continue that practice if she then becomes governor. She said that she would seek to ban that practice after she is elected. After she made those comments and after we reported on those comments, Kevin Nicholson, who is considering a run for governor, he said that, you know, anyone who would engage in ballot harvesting is, quote, dumb as a bag of hammers, I believe is what he said. So it's not, we're not sure if he's going to be getting in the race, but that was, you know, kind of taking a shot at Rebecca Clayfish on those comments.
And ballot harvesting, now, as I understand, I think from your piece, some states specifically allow it. Some states specifically ban it. And then there's states like Wisconsin. We're not in either of those categories. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So that's a phrase that Republicans use to disparage the practice of gathering absentee ballots from voters and returning them to clerks on their behalf. There were some reports of it in Wisconsin last year. It's not, you know, specifically outlawed in the state. I know that a lot of Republicans have made proposals and called for that practice to be banned since last year.
And in that same speech, Clayfish brought up the voting, the democracy in the park, they called it, efforts in Madison, where poll workers went to parks to allow people to drop off their completed absentee ballots. That's something different than ballot harvesting, but is often mentioned in the same breath. That's something that Republicans are talking about as well, right?
Right. That is different because you're dropping off your ballots with poll workers, you know, so that's like you going to a poll worker, which is not the same as what ballot harvesting is usually referred to. But it all gets kind of, you know, put in the same definition in these conversations. So it's kind of hard to parse out what people are talking about sometimes.
Molly, before we let you go, what's the next story you're watching for when it comes to our election laws and absentee voting procedures here in the state?
Well, we're obviously following the investigation launched by Assembly Republicans, headed up by the former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman. There's another review that was just started in the state Senate over a recent audit of the election, the 2020 election. So there are those two things. There's also a lot of calls by Republicans for the Elections Commission Administrator to resign. So we're, you know, obviously going to be following where that goes to.
Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Molly Beck, state government and politics reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we talked to her about latest developments involving ballots from a Racine nursing home last November and calls by Republican Rebecca Clayfish for so-called ballot harvesting in her bid for governor. We'll talk more about what that means and other demands for election law changes coming up. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the way elections are managed in Wisconsin? Are there changes you'd like to see made? Would you like the state to specifically allow what's called sometimes ballot harvesting, where somebody can collect ballots from a bunch of people and turn them in at once, or specifically ban it? Have you thought about being a poll worker yourself? Have you done that? What's it like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're looking at election issues here in Wisconsin. We just heard from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Molly Beck about Republican calls for the resignation of election officials after the Racine County Sheriff said state law was broken at a nursing home in the area. Also talked about a key Republican's call for her colleagues to engage in so-called ballot harvesting, balancing out, they say, what Democrats are doing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much confidence do you have in the integrity of Wisconsin's elections? Are there changes, maybe just clarifications you want to see when it comes to laws about ballot harvesting, lock boxes, and more? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David Cannon is professor of political science at UW-Madison. He's editor of the Election Law Journal and affiliated with the Elections Research Center. David, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
Let's start in Racine again. What's your reaction to these allegations by the Racine County Sheriff that the Wisconsin Elections Commission got it wrong when it came to how they handled voting in nursing homes?
Well, I think we have to all remember that this was an extraordinary election in so many ways. But the big relevant point here is that we had record voter turnout at the same time we still had a nationwide pandemic going on. And so the Election Commission was trying to deal with a very difficult situation where election clerks were already overwhelmed with the huge increase in the number of mailed-in ballots. And so even if the safety of the nursing homes would have allowed, you know, poll workers to go to the nursing homes the way they typically had in a non-pandemic year, that might not have been possible just in terms of the, you know, the person power they would have needed to do that. And so if you especially look back to the spring primaries where you only had a handful of polling places open in Milwaukee, you know, because of a shortage of poll workers, same thing happened in Green Bay and many states around the many municipalities around the state, that, you know, we just didn't have enough poll workers. Now, in the fall, we did have more poll workers, but leading up to the election, I'm sure that that was, you know, part of the problem that the Election Commission was hearing from clerks as well, is that they just didn't have the people to be able to do this, even if nursing homes were allowing people in, which they apparently found in the sheriff's investigation we're seeing, is that, you know, Molly mentioned the person cleaning the fish tanks and the DoorDash deliveries or whatever, they were letting them in, so why not the poll workers? But there are a lot of nursing homes around the state that still weren't. It really varied from place to place, and CDC guidelines said that, you know, depending on your infection rate, they were still recommending not allowing any people in, even family visitors in some areas if you had especially high infection rate. And so, you know, what happened in Racine in terms of that specific nursing home, you know, was not true in other parts of the state.
What happens in this impasse where, okay, you've got a rule saying, yeah, we're not letting extra people into these nursing homes, but law requires, a state statute says you're supposed to send them in. So you've got this, the state statute on the one hand, the violation of people's potential right to vote on the other. How do you square that?
Well, right. And this is where the Election Commission decided to err on the side of safety, and that we don't want to risk increased spread in the infection of people in nursing homes that were the most vulnerable population, you know, that we had, where many of the death rates, you know, were just, you know, through the roof in many nursing homes around the state early in the pandemic, but into the fall as well. And so the Election Commission erred on the side of trying to, you know, protect the health of voters, and then giving them their right to vote through absentee voting instead of the in-person deputies.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Merle is with us in Galena, Illinois. Merle, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm really frustrated. I've been an election worker for many years, and I hear all this malarkey about, you know, the vans coming in, dropping off ballots and stuff. It's impossible. Our local district, we are a small farming community, but the reality is there's checks and balances and checks and balances that we have to account for every single ballot. None can be brought in. We get so many ballots, and the ballots that are filled out are counted. The ballots that are not filled out are counted, and it has to match. And there's sometimes we spend 15 or 20 minutes looking for one ballot. So, you know, it's all bull. It's just bull.
Merle, thanks for the call. I think we have another poll worker with us. Tim in Kenosha County is on the line. Tim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, it's been a few years since I was a poll counter, but or poll worker, but as a previous caller stated, it's just ridiculous. If somebody's messing with, let's say one person running, and they say that it's been stolen, it's just mind-boggling to think how that would happen as a poll worker.
Tim, thanks for the call. I want to bring David Cannon back in on this. David, this is a couple poll workers saying the procedures are there. Large-scale fraud, they don't think is very likely.
No, and they're absolutely right that there are a lot of checks and oversight and double checking and triple checking, and we've had recounts, you know, in both in Dane County and Milwaukee County, and then the statewide, you know, audits too of machines. And so, yeah, we know that this was a very secure election. And one thing too that I want to bring up that we haven't mentioned yet is that both poll workers and election clerks are really feeling under fire now, and that, you know, because of all of these claims being made about stolen elections, it's getting harder and harder to recruit people to take on these positions, because you know you're going to be, you know, under fire no matter what you do, because it's become such a partisan issue that's so divisive. And so I think it is important to realize, especially, you know, these poll workers are often, they don't get paid very much to do this, and it's a difficult job. And if you're being harassed while you're sitting there trying to do your job, like with the poll watchers we see now in so many areas, that it really could make it more difficult to have well-run elections in the future if we can't recruit good people who are willing to be the poll workers and even election clerks. Cap Times just had a story last week about, you know, election clerks around the state under fire right now.
Talking to David Cannon from UW-Madison about election integrity and ballot harvesting. Let's bring on another caller. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Hey, I just had a question and a quick comment. You guys talked about ballot harvesting in the last session, but you really didn't talk about the details. If you could explain what they mean by ballot harvesting. And I guess my comment is, if you're lawfully... if you can lawfully cast a vote, why are we trying to prevent people from doing that? And I'll take my answer off here.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. And David, people have different definitions when they use the phrase ballot harvesting.
Yeah, ballot harvesting in the broadest sense is any time that someone other than the voter has a vote that's delivered to the voting official. And so the most sort of egregious example of this from recent years would have been the North Carolina 9th congressional race from a couple of years ago, where it was in 2018, you know, where there was someone, you know, hired by the Republican candidate in that race to go around picking up ballots, and they actually change the ballots then, and they would throw some away if they thought that this was someone who was, you know, voting for the Democrat. And there was enough evidence of this and clear evidence that they actually threw out that election. And so this has occasionally happened, but as both Merle and Tim pointed out in their calls, it's easy to detect this, though, because every ballot has to be accounted for. And you can see when ballots are changed in some systematic way like that. And so they did catch that case of ballot harvesting. And so this is something that has happened in the past, but has not ever been a problem here in Wisconsin in terms of, people actually, changing ballots, which, would be the illegal part, because under Wisconsin law, it's not illegal for someone to deliver a ballot for you, but it is obviously against the law to change that ballot.
And David, in our last minute, we heard from Molly that some states ban ballot harvesting, some states permit it and have guidelines for it. Wisconsin is in neither category. Would it make sense one way or the other to really clarify what you can and can't do when it comes to handing off your ballot and having somebody else turn it in?
Yeah, absolutely. And so let's say, for example, you're sick and you want to have some, you don't trust putting the ballot in the mail. You want to have the ballot actually delivered to the clerk's office, to have your parents or your wife or husband go deliver it for you. That would almost certainly be acceptable, I would think, under anyone's terms. But then maybe having people going around collecting hundreds of ballots would be something you might want to prohibit. That, I think, would be a great idea to clarify that. Also, drop boxes, another thing that the LRB report mentioned, something also that we don't have clear guidance on. It would be good for the Election Commission to say, okay, when can we use drop boxes, when shouldn't we, and what are the guidelines there? So, yes, having some clarification of rules would be a great thing here.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Well, it's good to be with you.
David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He's the editor of the Election Law Journal and is affiliated with the Elections Research Center. We talked to him today about some election integrity and voting issues here in Wisconsin. We also heard earlier from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Molly Beck. We'll have more, by the way, on related topics tomorrow with a disability rights advocacy group talking about how people in nursing homes can have access to voting and other related issues in the way our elections are accessible for people. Again, that's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on the morning show, Let There Be Light Fixtures. On this week's edition of Ask a Contractor, get advice on lighting options for your home and what goes into installing those light fixtures. And as always on this Ask a Contractor segment, you get to join in with your question. If you have a conundrum facing you for your upcoming weekend project or plans down the future, join the conversation. That's tomorrow at 8 on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn about a new study looking at harmful algae blooms, what the results tell us about climate change, and what fixing the problem could look like. Now, little free libraries are all over the place in Wisconsin. There are some parts of the state where it's hard to walk a few blocks without seeing at least one. An artist in Green Bay decided to put her own unique twist on little free libraries by creating a little free art gallery, which is now stationed in front of her home in Green Bay. Amy Zander is a teaching artist based in Green Bay. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. It's my pleasure.
Where did the inspiration for your little free art gallery come from?
Well, I've been creating for as long as I can remember, and now as a full-time artist, I get to work from my studio, which is located in my backyard. And I got to experience the little free libraries firsthand with my granddaughters. They have one in their neighborhood. And every time I'd go to visit, the girls would want to go and check it out and see what was inside. But they used theirs for books and DVDs and toys and things like that. And it was lots of goodies, and it was a lot of fun. So I was inspired by that, but I needed to make it my own because our neighborhood is pretty creative and we don't have a lot of children. So I thought filling it with art was the perfect fit for me anyway. And I've heard about a little free art gallery on the East Coast, so I wanted in. They're gaining a little momentum and are popping up all over. And hopefully someday we're going to have just as many little free art galleries as we do the little libraries. Like I said, our neighborhood is pretty creative. So after discussing it with my husband, the project was a go. A few days later, it was my birthday. And my husband told me that he wanted to actually build me one as my birthday gift. So we were off and running.
Okay. So, Amy, if I showed up on opening day at your little free art gallery, what would I have found it stocked with?
Actually, I peeked in. It's a lot of fun. Every day I go to, to design it and move things around and to see what has been chosen to take home and what is new to be dropped off. So this morning there were there's some paintings in there from me, and some other people had dropped off some things, a fused glass bug that I have dropped off. Knitting is new. We've had a couple of knitted pieces. There's actually a green and gold little pumpkin in there now. Painted stones, photography, ceramic pieces. You know, it's just exciting to see Green Bay embrace this, and all the creative people are coming together and dropping off. You don't have to drop off just to take. You can come look. We've gotten some people that just open the door just to look to see what's going on. Like I said, it's there. If you like it, take it with you. If you are a maker and you feel you'd like to donate something to the gallery, you can leave it in and take something with you. Lots of different options, but the goal of the gallery is just to spread happiness and share, creating smiles, especially during a pandemic. I mean, everybody needs to have something that makes them smile, and to go for a walk in our neighborhood and open the door and find something that makes them smile, and to be able to take it home just for free, just because, you know, they're out. They took the time to stop and to look, you know, makes me happy.
And you're hoping to inspire people to create also by putting, I understand, some art supplies that people can take from the art gallery.
Absolutely. As a teaching artist, it's important to me to encourage people to give art a try. So inside of the gallery, I have a small little basket of art supplies like markers, crayons, paper, pencils, you know, that type of thing. So how long has it been since you've had a crayon in your hand?
When I was probably taking it away from one of my kids, I'll say, when they were drawing on the wrong thing.
And I even have paper in there, and just a fun little thing. I opened up the gallery one morning, and somebody had took one of the sheets of paper from that little box and made a little origami frog out of it. So they took the time to do it. So it was really cool. I also have an Instagram page for it, which is gaining momentum. So at Little Free Art Gallery GB. And I had one of the followers on that on my Instagram page actually contact me, and she sent me a painting all the way from Maryland that she wanted to share as an artist with my little gallery. So yeah, it was in there. It only lasted, you know, like a day, and somebody spotted it and took it home. But you know, we're spreading art all over, and you know, taking the opportunity to, you know, spread some smiles and giving with the little supplies that are in there too. Chalk art is in there too. So if you don't have something at home to give it a try, you know, stop by, and there's always something in there to get the creativity flowing. It's a lot
Amy,
of fun.
Amy, I think a lot of people might think of, when they hear the phrase art class, they think of something they did when they were a kid in school. Can you make the case that us grown-ups can get something out of taking a class or just trying some creativity on our own at home?
Yep, absolutely. I mean, my husband, who built the art gallery for me, I mean, it's even got a shingled roof on it. I said, okay, even though that you created the gallery for me, you need to put something inside. So he just drew a face. I took a piece of my watercolor paper that I had in the studio, and just a smiley face, you know, two eyes, a nose, a smile, a little square. It was about 2-inch square. He put it in, and what took a little longer, but maybe like 5 days later, it was gone. You should have seen the happy hands that he did. It's just that simple. Kids' art. You know, my first actually donation to the Little Free Art Gallery was from my granddaughter, who's 4. So it's not just for adults. Art is everywhere. Like I said, if you can hold a pencil and doodle, it's in. Absolutely.
Amy, before I let you go, are you hoping that other people will run with this idea in other neighborhoods around Green Bay, other communities around the state?
Yes, absolutely. Sharing art, the art community is huge. All of us, you know, we're made out of the same cloth, and we all love to share our art with others. And I think I'm the first one in quite a distance around here. I think we've been getting lots of feedback, but absolutely. If anybody's got any questions and wants to know how to do it, you know, contact me. You can follow me on my website. If you want to know more information about me, amyzander.com is an easy way to reach me. If you've got any questions about starting your own, it's a lot of fun. We're on Facebook too. Amy Zander Studio on Facebook. You can reach me that way too. And it's just fun. Everybody needs to have a smile and to feel good. Absolutely.
Amy, thanks so much for sharing your art and sharing your project with us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Amy Zander, a teaching artist in Green Bay who has created a little free art gallery outside of her home. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about having the gift of seeing spirits.
Everyone likes a good ghost story, especially around this time of year. Dorothy Malone of Milwaukee shared a childhood encounter with the supernatural at Xfabula's Story Slam Identity event held in March of 2020.
I was a little girl, and I was able to see ghosts. I could see them all the time, everywhere. Someone told me that if you throw salt over your shoulders, that would get rid of them. So I got every box of Morton salt I can find and just tossing them. Now I'm going down this dark hallway. I see a white shadowy figure. So now I'm cursing, not again. You know, and I'm like, oh my God. So I'm trembling at about 10 years old. And I have heard that they cannot hurt you. You only can hurt yourself. Oh, that was, now I'm running in the walls, falling down the stairs, you know, outside at 3 o'clock in the morning. So as time went on, I heard that poltergeists will leave children by the time they're 13 years old. So I can't wait till I'm 13. I just can't wait. I mean, hurry up, you know, because all this time these ghosts are effing with me. So someone said, oh, if you curse them out, then they'll leave. So now I'm having a field day. Leave me to hell. My mother said, whoa, what's going on in there? So that didn't last too long because I got spanked. You know, I got whipped. You know, I'll be using that mouthwash, ivory soap, and all of that. But I'm thinking this would have the ghost leave me alone. Now, here I am at 13, no ghosts. I'm like, oh my God, they're gone, only to have one hovering above my bed. Now, I get the blanket, throw it over it, and give it a look. Go somewhere, I don't want to see you no more. It was howling too while it was up running there. I was doing all I beat this shit out of. But I learned I have a gift. And part of my identity is that I could, in black terms, read people. I can tell a little bit about your spirit by talking to you. I can tell, you know, you can't play a player, so I know if you're trying me, then I can tell that, you know, and I just have a way with babies. They would just look at me and like, that's a good person. That's the good one right there. And the little kids be like, a compliment all the time. I like your glasses. I like your wig. I'm like, thank you. going through that experience and always trying to find a meaning in life or why I'm here, or looking to the cosmos for my existence. I think that had a part in it growing up with these ghostly images all around me. But today, you know, I'm at peace with them. I don't fear them as much. And that's my story.
Dorothy Malone's story comes to us from Xfabula, a storytelling organization based in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, a new study from a UW lake researcher had a surprising finding about harmful algae blooms when it comes to climate change. We'll get the details and what it tells us about how we can protect the health of lakes here in the state. That's next year on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, when we're talking about algae in lakes, there can be good kinds and bad kinds. It can be a vital photosynthesizing component of an underwater ecosystem, or it can multiply wildly and be toxic to people and animals in and around the water. So the more we can learn about why these harmful algae blooms happen, the more we can do to prevent them. Our next guest looked at the impact of climate change on those blooms and found less of a link than previously thought. Grace Wilkinson is an assistant professor at the UW-Madison Center for Limnology. Grace, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me on.
Well, before we get into your research on climate change and these algae blooms, can you talk about why these algae blooms, the bad kinds, are such a big deal in our lakes?
Yeah, absolutely. So algal blooms are really bad for the health of lake ecosystems, particularly when there's just a lot of algal growth. So we probably all know those times where we've looked at a lake and it sort of looks like pea soup or it's really green. And of course, they're not pleasant to be around either. They smell bad, they look terrible. It's not fun to be on that lake boating or recreating or just to be around it. And as you mentioned, some blooms also produce toxins, and those can be very harmful to humans as well as our pets and other wildlife. And so we really don't want these harmful algal blooms to be around in our lakes.
We hear people talking about blue-green algae or cyanobacteria. That's one of the ones we really worry about, right?
Absolutely. And some of those taxa or species of cyanobacteria can produce those toxins that we worry so much about and are often monitoring our waters for.
The thinking has been that climate change, generally warmer weather, was going to make these algae blooms worse and more common. Again, before we get to your research, why did we think that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, just like us humans, often algae really like it when it's warm, right? So they enjoy the hot weather, the warm temperatures. They can grow faster, acquire nutrients faster, all of those processes that they do to grow. And so if temperatures are rising, it's going to make the waters warmer, and the algae really like that. It also tends to make the water a bit more stable. So in terms of the warm water at the top of the lake, or what we refer to as the epilimneon, versus the colder water in the bottom, it tends to keep those layers really strongly stratified, and the algae really benefit from that as well. And so for a while, lake scientists have suspected that blooms would be getting worse in lakes because of these rising temperatures.
So you tried to figure out, okay, is this really happening? How did you do that?
Yeah, so my colleagues and I really wanted to know if our perceptions and our ideas about how blooms might have been changing over the past few decades was actually matched by the data. And so we looked around at a number of different state agencies and other databases that had been put together, and we found over 300 lakes that had data on the algal amount of algae in the water, what we call the algal biomass, that had over the past decade. So these were data sets that had been collected by state agencies, by volunteers, by other academic scientists like myself, for at least the past decade, measuring the amount of algal biomass in the lake. And we looked at those over 300 lakes to examine whether or not there were any trends or how algal blooms were changing. Were they getting worse, more intense, more severe? Were they staying the same, or were they actually getting better?
And
what we found, surprisingly, was about 1 in 10 lakes, so about 11% of lakes, are getting worse. Algal blooms were intensifying. So maybe they were increasing in their severity, or they were sticking around longer, their duration was longer. But what we found, and was very surprising to us, was that actually 1 out of 6 lakes, or about 16%, are getting significantly better. So more lakes actually have algal blooms becoming less intense than more intense. And that was, of course, very surprising to us, because we had assumed that because temperatures are rising all over the globe, that we would see that algal blooms are getting worse in most lakes.
Talking to Grace Wilkinson with the UW-Madison Center for Limnology, looking at harmful algae blooms in our lakes here in the state and the role climate change might play in making it worse. Maybe it's not, at least so far, it looks like from this research. So, Grace, if climate change isn't the variable, what is it do we think that might make a lake over there get worse over time, a lake over here get better over time?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so we wanted to dig in a little bit more to try to understand that exact thing. Why were lakes responding so differently to what seemed like a driver that was happening everywhere, climate change? We did find some evidence, but it was mostly anecdotal, that water quality policies, so things like the Clean Water Act, may be helping lakes that are getting better. But unfortunately, we couldn't explicitly include those in our models and our analysis, just because there's not enough concrete data out there. There's not a central repository where lake managers put in the information about what's happening in their watersheds or their lakes. So that's really hard to get at. And we actually had to rely a lot on local news stations and newspapers for stories about lake restoration that was happening. So we have some evidence of that. But I think more interestingly, what we did find was a really interesting interaction between extreme storms, so extreme precipitation events, and lakes that were already really rich in nutrients. So algae really love nutrients. It helps them grow. They need that phosphorus and that nitrogen. And so lakes that already have a lot of that, if the storms that occur during the summer are getting more and more severe and more extreme, then those lakes were more likely to be getting worse algal blooms over time. But in the same sort of lake that was nutrient rich, but storms were actually getting less and less intense over the summer, those lakes were more likely to be getting substantially better in terms of algal blooms. So while it's not this temperature climate change hypothesis that we all were assuming was going to be at play, there is sort of this interaction in terms of climate change and how it's changing our precipitation patterns or our storms. And that's certainly something that we're experiencing right here in Wisconsin.
When it comes to human contributions to these algae blooms in our lakes, are there things we know that make things worse or at least raise the potential to make things worse, the sorts of things we do in a watershed?
Absolutely. So nutrient inputs, that nitrogen and phosphorus into lakes, are what's fueling those algal blooms. And so everything that we can do to control those nutrient inputs is really important. So we often refer to that as eutrophication, or the additional enrichment of nutrients in the water. And so any way that we can control the nutrients that we're putting onto land, or control that those nutrients that we are putting onto the land not getting into lakes, is really important. So whether those are sources in agricultural land uses, or it's urban waste, it's septic systems, all of those things contribute. And in particular, once phosphorus gets into the lakes, it gets stored into the sediments and is then slowly released again over time. And so this legacy phosphorus that's stored down in the sediments can help fuel algal blooms, even if no nutrients were added from the surrounding watershed. And so it's really important to be thinking about what we can do now to control nutrients, because it's going to help now, but it's also going to be a long-term process as that phosphorus that's stored in the sediments of some of these lakes continues to fuel blooms. So it's a long road ahead, and the interaction of this and storms, or that component of climate change, more extreme storms, is really going to be changing in the future as well. And so we need to be adaptive in how we manage our nutrients, not just what we're doing now and is working, but what's going to work in the future because of these extreme storms.
Well, let me throw, a good news read on your research here, Grace. If climate change was making all lakes inexorably worse over the years, that might tell, you know, a local community there's not much you can do about algae blooms in your lake. But if I'm hearing you right, this isn't happening with climate change, so actions taken at that local level in a lake's watershed can make a difference. Does that sound reasonable?
Absolutely. Actions at the local level and in a watershed that reduce nutrient inputs into the lake are always going to be helpful. And I think what our study helps identify are those lakes that are maybe a little bit more at risk or susceptible to changing and getting worse based on what we've seen in the recent past. And so we can identify those lakes and put more of our very limited resources, perhaps, towards monitoring and managing those ecosystems and being better freshwater stewards. And it might also help identify some of the lakes where we don't need to be as concerned. We still need to keep a watchful eye, but maybe not put as much of our resources, because those lakes might not be as much at risk.
In just our last half minute, Grace, what's the next mystery you're hoping to solve when it comes to algae and lakes?
Yeah. So I think these are exciting trends, but what we found are patterns over these 300 lakes. And so our next challenge is to really dig into the why and try to understand, just like you were saying, why this lake and not that lake is getting worse. And I think we have some exciting opportunities in the near future to be doing that and trying to understand in particular how to be better managers and freshwater stewards by answering that question.
Grace, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Grace Wilkinson, assistant professor at the UW-Madison Center for Limnology. We talked to her today about the new results of a study she led looking at harmful algae blooms in water ecosystems and whether climate change has had anything to do with their growth. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, nursing home residents can have a difficult time voting. A Wisconsin sheriff argues that the rules were bent in at least one facility. A disability rights advocate joins the show to look at the best ways to make voting accessible. And young adults are getting married at a lower rate than they used to, and those single adults may be taking an economic hit along the way. We'll take a look at the past, present, and future of marriage and money, and you could join in maybe with your own story. You can let us know now at the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.